My name is Dan Austin. This is Friday morning, 11 a.m. at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Walter Red Barber in Tallahassee, Florida. This recording is on behalf of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And I'll start with Red. Would you tell us something about your background, where you were born, and how you came involved in broadcasting?
Dan, we were all born someplace, and we have no control over it. I had some control in later years about where I went. I was born in Columbus, Mississippi, February 17, 1908. My mother's people had been in Columbus for some three generations, and they had founded one of the earliest newspapers in the state. And for various reasons, Irish temperament and etc., they lost the paper. And my mother was teaching school and trying to raise two younger sisters and a younger brother. And in those days, there were boarding houses where you lived and got your meals, and she was there. My father came from North Carolina, and he came into Columbus, Mississippi to work on the Southern Railroad in Mississippi, which finally got eaten up by the boll weevil. But he stayed at that boarding house, and that's where my parents met. And I've heard my father say that when he and my mother were married at the home of the Presbyterian minister, my mother a Presbyterian, my father a Baptist, that they walked home, and he already had a family, because my mother's younger brother and two sisters. And later they had three children, my sister, who was 2 years younger, and my brother, who was born on Christmas Day, who was 7 years younger. My sister is still living. She's in Jackson, Mississippi. My brother died some 15 years ago of lung cancer. And when I was 10, my father got a job on the Atlantic Coastline Railroad in Florida and moved the family to Sanford. I mentioned earlier the boll weevil had a very negative effect on railroading in Mississippi. My father, as a hobby, raised and trained pit bull terriers. And I've heard him say many times that in those desperate years in Columbus, if it hadn't been for being able to train dogs and sell puppies, he don't think that he never thought the family would make it. Times were very, very hard. I remember the Christmases in Columbus. There wouldn't have been much Christmas except for my father's sister, my Aunt Virginia, who always had a big box for the family and for the three children.
And so growing up, in some very rough times, and then...
There was never any easy money in the family. My father struggled. He never had any extra money. When he got to railroading in Florida, there was a busy season in the winter in which he worked, you see, on his rest. And as soon as he would get his sleep, he'd go back again. And then there wouldn't be any business in the summer. So he would have to do business with a grocery store that would carry him in the summer. So my memory of my father was he was always working to get out of debt. And mother taught school and did very well at teaching school in Sanford and was a principal of a new school when she became ill with a final illness. So we grew up in a family in which there just was no extra money.
Close-knit, and everybody had a job to do to help keep the family together and bring in some money.
I know.
What were some of your first jobs as a kid?
My pardon?
What were some of your first jobs as a teenager or even younger?
Fine. I'll tell you, but I think the best way to say about the financial state of the family was I was a Boy Scout. And think the world of scouting. Became an Eagle Scout. But there was never enough money for me to have anything more in the way of a scout uniform than one shirt. That's all I ever had of a Boy Scout uniform. And I think that gives the idea. We always had a good house. And my father always demanded that we had a good table. And he was a wonderful cook himself.
And with school clean?
We ate well. We were a devoted family. Mm-hmm. But there was no extra money. When I finished high school, there was no thought of my going to college, mm-hmm. as far as the family was concerned. And by that time, my mother was ill, and my father was very definitely hard-pressed mm-hmm. with two other children and my mother's illness. Now, as far as my work was concerned, my Sunday school teacher was the city and county city engineer and surveyor, Fred Williams. And he gave me a job working on a civil engineering crew after my third year in high school. Mm-hmm. And during the Christmas holiday in my senior year in high school. And when I finished high school, I just automatically went to work for Mr. Williams. Times were not good, and I got $5 a day. My father wouldn't take any expenses for my being at home. Mm-hmm. So as a young man, I had $30 a week net money, when $30 was a lot of money. So I guess you might say I became the first wealthy member mm-hmm. of the family. But then the Florida boom collapsed.
This was late 1920s.
Yep, and mm-hmm. about 1927, mm-hmm. 28. And the civil engineering job disappeared. There were no more roads to be built, no more lots to be staked. And I went from one odd job to another as a day laborer. And the last odd job I had in Sanford was working for a man who put on built-up roofs. My job was to keep a fire going under a barrel of pitch pine so it would be liquid, and I would take this boiling, melting pine up on the roof to where this man would spread it as he worked on built-up roofs. And that got to be a very hot job in the summer of 1928 mm-hmm. in Sanford. And I began thinking that at least I ought to try to work my way through college. I didn't know what I wanted to do or be, but anything would be better than what I was then doing in Sanford. Mm-hmm. I just had enough sense driven into my head that I wasn't going any place as a day laborer in a small town in Central Florida. And I went up to the University of Florida with $100. That's all I had. And one job after another, odd jobs, I managed to stay in school. And one job led to another. My second year in school, I got a job as a professor, as a janitor in a bachelor professor's club, which I got my room. And I had located a job waiting tables for my meals. Well, you can't get a fellow out if he can eat and sleep, so I was in school. The quirk of fate, it takes some money out of your life and you don't know what it would have been, mm-hmm. was that one of the bachelor professors was named Ralph Folger, and he was in the School of Agriculture. And WRUF, mm-hmm. Radio University of Florida, radio station on the campus of the university, 5,000 watts, strictly educational, daylight operated, had been on the air for 2 years. And Fudgeon put on a 45-minute farm program 5 days a week. And he came in the university club where I was the janitor one day, all in a swivet, and he asked if anybody, the other profs were in the building, and I said no. When he said, would you come over to the radio station with me? I've got three papers I've got to read. All professors who had written them have left mm-hmm. town. If you'd read the middle papers, it's change of pace. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I'm busy. I haven't lost anything at the radio station. Well, he said, I'll buy you dinner tonight if you read one of these papers. Well, I said, for that, I'll read all three. No, he said, one be enough. So I went over with him to the station and read the paper. It was a very factual dissertation on bovine obstetrics. Mm-hmm. And I understood as I read it, I hadn't read it before I got on the mm-hmm. microphone, I never had in my mind to do that, why the professor didn't want to read that paper. But after I had finished the paper, I started to leave the station and go back to the university club. And a man came up and said, did you just read this paper? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I made you Powell. Garland Powell, and I'm the new director of the station, and I need a part-time student announcer. Your voice registered. How about going to work out here at 35 cents an hour? And I said, no, thank you. I can't do that. I don't have the time. I'm taking extra hours, 21 hours, mm-hmm. all they let me take. I wanted to get out of school in a hurry mm-hmm. in 3 years. After all, it was my education. I was working for it. And I said, I have a job as janitor, and I have a job waiting tables, and that's all the time I have. And I left. Well, he kept sending word by Fulgham for me to come out there and go to work.
He was
and
persistent.
Fulgham got a little irritated and said, I wish you'd go to the station and get Major Powell off my back. I said, sure. So I went out, and he said, why won't you come out here and go to work? And I said, I told you once, I'll tell you again, I don't have the time, and further, I don't have the interest. He said, well, I know when I offered you the job, it was 35 cents an hour. How much would I have to guarantee you a month for you to take the job? Times were very hard. The depression was really on mm-hmm. now. So I just said to myself, well, $10 a month, I can get a room. $20, $25 a month, I can eat. I said, I'll ask him for all the money there is. He won't give it to me, and I'll mm-hmm. settle that. I said, $50 a month. He said, you start tomorrow. And my feet really dragged the next day as I walked away mm-hmm. from my security room and meals mm-hmm. to start something I knew nothing about, was not interested in, at that radio station. So mm-hmm. when people ask me over the years, mm-hmm. how do you get started in radio, I usually say, well, it's a long story.
Okay, well, I'm glad that it's down for the record that, a resonant voice, one that spoke precisely and clearly, and that man saw the talent and finally persuaded you to do it. When it came to sports, though, you know, there weren't many professional or sports except at the university. Did you get involved in the baseball or football in broadcasting the games in those days?
So much of my life has been by chance. It causes me to wonder. Maybe I've been led by grace. I don't know. When Major Powell offered me the job and insisted that I go out there and go to work, I didn't speak very distinctly. I had a very heavy Southern accent. I don't think I said ERs or RNGs very plainly. And why he was so insistent on my going, I've often wondered.
Mm-hmm.
I've often wondered. And then when I started on the station, he was a very good teacher. I tried to be a formal radio announcer, as I'd heard over the mm-hmm. year, Milton J. Cross, et cetera, et cetera. And he called me in one day and said, now listen, you quit trying to be Walter Barber and an announcer. You just be Red Barber, be yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the best advice anybody I can give anyone, mm-hmm. particularly in the field of show business. And I just relaxed. And then as a matter of a change, the sports that had been done for a year or so had been done by a fellow in the law school named Jack Thompson. And his father was the Thompson of Thompson and Smathers, a very prestigious mm-hmm. law firm in Miami. The Smathers was the father of the senator.
Oh, George Smathers.
That's right. So I think that Jack's father down in Miami got a little restive about his son fooling around the radio station and not paying too much attention to his law books. And in those days, if you passed the bar, you could be a lawyer. You didn't have to get a degree.
Okay.
So Jack's father summoned him to Miami. You come down here and read law in my office and get your degree, and you get out of Gainesville. I don't mm-hmm. want you at that radio station. I want you in my law office. So Thompson went down. That was that. So when the football season came around, there was nobody there at the station who'd ever announced a football game. You have to remember that the station has just been on the air 2 years. This mm-hmm. is 1930.
Mm-hmm.
Radio was just very new. KDKA mm-hmm. was just 10 years old.
Oh, well, Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm.
So I was like Patrick Henry. I had no light to guide me or anything else. So the first football game came around, and I played high school football, and I just asked Major Powell if he didn't have anybody else, would he let me announce it? And that was probably the worst announced football game in the history of radio. I didn't know enough to, we didn't have numbers on the players, and I didn't have enough to take a program or a scratch sheet or pencils mm-hmm. or have mm-hmm. spotters. I just showed up with a microphone in the booth and suffered through it. Tampa Tribune, which was never very favorable to the radio station, mm-hmm. which then was operated by the state legislature, mm-hmm. had a little editorial, first time I ever made the editorial page. I didn't make it by name, but I made it. It's had a little thing. It said, it looks like that white elephant of a radio station up there in Gainesville could spend at least some of the taxpayers' money enough to get somebody to announce a football game who knows how to announce it.
I'll get it.
And Major Powell said, well, I think we'd better let somebody else do the next game. And then the third game, he had somebody else do it, and they didn't do any ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had learned the hard way how to announce a football game that first one. So I had been going to practice and talking to Nash Higgins, who had scouted the opposing mm-hmm. teams. I knew I needed spotting charts mm-hmm. and spotters, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I learned in one game how to do it. And I said to Major Powell, give me another chance. And he didn't have anybody else. So the second chance worked out all right.
Good.
So I've been doing football games ever since. When I say by grace, radio was so early and the situation was such that nobody was around. I was given a chance to learn on the audience. Nobody has that opportunity today.
Very few. There might be a few, but not many people can learn by trial and error and getting paid for it nowadays.
Well, yes, some people can. And that sticks in my craw a little bit. These former great athletes, they put them on the air, mm-hmm. like Phil Rizzuto had never done an inning of a baseball game in his life, and the sponsor, Valentine Beer, said, we want him on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So that started his career. So he learned on the audience, too.
Well,
but
true.
He had two professional broadcasters helping him, guiding him,
mm-hmm.
in Mel Allen and in me.
That's right.
I say, I was alone, and just out there all by myself.
I guess Rizzuto was probably one of the earliest athletes turned broadcaster.
No, there
have been quite a few before that?
Yeah, quite a few.
Well, I'd like to come back to that. You went into baseball. You became, from what I have, a broadcaster in 1934, and according to a baseball encyclopedia that I have here. Did you start in the minor leagues with the old teletype machine,
no,
with the clicking and
no,
all that?
No, I said, I was at the radio station on mm-hmm. the campus of the University of Florida,
mm-hmm.
WRUF, and I stayed there until I went to Cincinnati in 1934 to the Reds.
Now, so you made a
jump. You want to hold on?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then they soon developed into some powerhouses.
When I was at the WRUF on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Daylight operated, 5,000 watts, no commercials, controlled by the legislature. It was automatic. I knew that if I wanted to stay in radio, and I had discovered that I liked radio mm-hmm. and wanted to stay in radio, I fell in love with it once I was exposed to it, I knew I would have to go to a commercial radio station. And I had a route. I went to Atlanta, I went to Louisville, I went to Cincinnati, always to Cincinnati, to WLW.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they had the big transmitter, 500,000 watts, the experimental transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, they called it the nation station. It blanketed the nation. And once I went to Chicago and always took auditions. Went to Nashville, Tennessee, always looking for a better job. And the stations would say to me, well, we don't have any openings. In fact, we've just let some people off.
Mm-hmm.
Repeat again, the Great Depression was on.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want an audition, we'll give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd take the auditions, and they would say, gee, your audition is fine. And when I'd get back to Gainesville, I would keep in touch with these people mm-hmm. by letter. I'd write them about every 2 months, anything I could think about, just mm-hmm. to keep my name fresh. I said earlier that we're all creatures of changes and chances, etc. In the Great Depression, Sidney Weill, who owned the Cincinnati Reds, went bankrupt. He was an automobile dealer,
mm-hmm.
and he lost the ball club. The bank had to take it over. And the bank brought in, on the advice of Branch Rickey, Larry MacPhail. And mm-hmm. MacPhail's first assignment was to find somebody in Cincinnati to buy the debts of Weill and get the bank. The bank mm-hmm. didn't want to be in the baseball business. They didn't realize in those days that it was a very valuable asset. They wanted to be out of it.
When they looked
and MacPhail found about the only man in Cincinnati with money was Powell Crosley Jr., who with that 500,000 watt radio station was making more money than the Treasury could print. So Mr. Crosley, that's how he got into baseball. He bailed the bank out and took over the Reds. Mr. Crosley, in addition to that big station, had a little 5,000 watt station in Cincinnati called WSAI. And he then said to his staff, well, now I've got a ball club and two radio stations. I guess I ought to broadcast a few of my games. Have we got somebody here that does baseball? Mm-hmm. The chief announcer said, no. But, oh, honey, baby. Mr. Crosby said, now that I've got a ball club and two radio stations, I guess I should broadcast some of my games. Do we have anybody on the staff who does baseball? The chief announcer said, no, but that boy that's been up here three times on his, at his own expense from Florida says he does baseball. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Crosby said, well, send for him. So I got a telegram. It was on the 4th of March, 1934, and it said very simply, would you come to Cincinnati, do Reds games, $25 a week, answer soonest. At $25 a week may sound funny, but again, the Depression was on. Nobody paid much money. Mm-hmm. And as far as my doing baseball, I had done baseball at Gainesville, University of Florida baseball games, mm-hmm. American Legion Junior mm-hmm. baseball games, the Northeast Florida League semi-pro games, mm-hmm. and they never asked me in Cincinnati had I done any professional ball games, and I never volunteered the information. Mm-hmm. So the first game I did opening day at Cincinnati was the first professional game, say nothing of the major leagues, that I'd ever done, ever seen. So that's how I broke in. Again, I guess people don't break in that way anymore.
It would be rare.
Yeah.
Red, you know, you've seen some, and now comes through baseball, some fantastic teams. In fact, when you went to Cincinnati, you saw the... Well, they had two or three championship seasons right there in a row. You had Frank McCormick. You had Johnny Van Meer.
You're a little ahead of that.
Oh, am I? Okay.
Yeah. In 1934, the Reds had one of the worst teams in the history of baseball, which was a great blessing to me, learning my profession as a broadcaster, because the Reds were defeated opening day by Lon Wanicki and the Chicago Cubs. Mm-hmm. They were not only defeated, they lost with a shutout. And Wanicki didn't give up a hit until one man was out in the ninth inning. That's the only hit he gave up. The Reds in 1934 went into eighth place opening day and never came out. Never
came out.
Never even threatened to come out the whole season.
The reverse of this year.
So I learned very early that that you just have to announce a ball game and try and get as much interest in it as you can, the players and this, that, and the other, because the winning or the losing was certainly not a factor. In fact, they had an all-time heat wave in Cincinnati that summer. For 10 days and nights, the temperature never came down below 100. And at that time, the Reds in eighth place, you couldn't give a pass away with that that situation. That was very, very hard work, but it was very formative. And MacPhail was putting in a farm system and building. Mm-hmm. He was there 3 years. Then Warren Giles came in. Mm-hmm. The Reds' first pennant was in 1939, and I was not there. I had gone to Brooklyn.
Oh, you had gone on to Brooklyn.
And then the Reds' second pennant, that is in that cycle, mm-hmm. was the very next year, and that mm-hmm. year they won the World Series from mm-hmm. Detroit.
Okay. So you had to make this game exciting with a last place contender, or last place finisher. What did you learn, go about learning something about the players themselves, that you could give some what they call color today to the broadcast?
That's right. That's right. That's what I meant, but I had to work. I had to be able to explain the players. I had to be able to talk about the players. And I had to put more into the broadcast than just the winning and the losing.
Mm-hmm. So you became a journalist in that sense. A journalist. You really became a journalist.
I like to think so.
A question that...
I'm going to try to put it in.
No, leave him alone. He's all right.
The question that I like to pose, because it would span your entire career in broadcasting, and that is, do you see, you have to be a fan of baseball to enjoy it.
No, I was not a fan.
You were not a fan.
No, I learned early not to be a fan. The thing that is important...
As opposed to a journalist.
The thing that is important to understand, I think, in my business, is that vision is maybe more emotional than it is physical. We see what we want to see. We see the team win that we want to see win. We see the batter hit that we want to see hit. We see the pitcher strike out the opposing battery if we want to see him strike it out. This is why there's a constant difference of the evaluation between the fans and the officials, the referees and the umpires. And I learned in 2 years' time completely that my job was to announce the baseball. Bill Clem, the great umpire, said that all there was to umpiring was to umpire the ball without mm-hmm. any emotion. Mm-hmm. The player is either safe or he's out. The ball is either fair or foul, or it's a ball or a strike. When you get down to it, that's pretty basic. And I tried to announce the ball, and then at the end of my second year in the big leagues, 35, I was on the World Series, Detroit and Chicago. Judge Landis was the commissioner, and then all the networks broadcast the World Series. Mm-hmm. That was the first World Series for Mutual. It was just starting up. And the judge, I'll make this very simple, said to us, you let the players play. You broadcast, report what they do. You let the managers manage, report what they
do. So don't speculate about what their next moves are going
to be? You let the umpires umpire, etc. Leave your opinions in your hotel room. Just report. When you think about it, that sums it up. I had a little problem facing emotionally the coming of the first black player, because I'd been raised in the South, of mm-hmm. course. But then when I heard Judge Landis's voice say, report, suddenly there was no problem. I wasn't Branch Rickey, who brought in Jackie Robinson. I wasn't DeRocher, who was going to be the manager. I wasn't the players who would play with him. I wasn't the player. What was my job? My job was to report what this player did, whether he was white or black.
But Red, you were hired by a ball team to help bring in fans to keep the franchise going, so you had to be a fan in some ways,
no.
some kind of enthusiasm. And so,
I had enthusiasm for the game and for the events and for the people in the ballpark, but I was reporting it. It wasn't what I wanted to see done. See, the fan wants to see his team win.
Sure.
Well, I didn't go to the ballpark that way. I went to the ballpark and prepared myself to announce what was going to happen in the ball game to at times millions of people who couldn't see the game for themselves, and each of them had their own emotional opinions.
Mm-hmm.
The best compliment ever paid to me was Tom Meaney, who was a baseball writer for the World Telegram at this time, was late going to Ebbets Field in Brooklyn and jumped in a taxi. And the taxi stopped for a red light, and the taxi driver, not knowing who Meaney was, just happened to say over his shoulder, he was listening to the play-by-play of the ball game. Mm-hmm. He said, well, the trouble with that barber is he's too fair. So I like that.
You like that? I like that. That was the utmost compliment. Well, never, let me ask you this then. I've heard Vince Scully say that he considers you his mentor.
I was.
And I'd like to add this point to ask you your reaction to it, that we talk about, well, with the great ball players of yesteryear in the 30s and 40s and early 50s, would they be great today? Now, could I ask you then, with the great broadcasters of the 1930s and 40s, if the game has changed and everything, would they be also great today?
There's no way I can answer that, to go back to Vince Scully saying I was his mentor.
Mm-hmm.
I hired him to come to Ebbets Field and work with Connie Desmond and me, and he had never done an inning of a professional ball game. So Connie and I taught him on the air,
mm-hmm.
and I was determined that any mistake he made, I would correct it. And when I corrected it over the air, it was a little painful. He never repeated it again. But he was very, very apt. Mm-hmm. One of the things I taught him was a thorough preparation before each game, so that when he came into the booth, he knew what was going on, why the players were playing and why those who weren't playing were not playing. I'm very proud of Scully. I think mm-hmm. he's by far the best play-by-play man in our city today.
Excellent broadcaster.
And as far as broadcasters then are concerned, the broadcasters today, it's entirely different. My last year was 1966,
mm-hmm.
and this was before free agencies. This was before mm-hmm. the players had agents. This was before the tremendous impact financially of television.
Mm-hmm.
The union was just started that year by Marvin Miller.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an entirely different game today. The designated hitter had not come into the American League my last mm-hmm. year in baseball. And I have been careful, Dan, over the years, not to have opinions and be critical of the status today as mm-hmm. compared to how I remember it yesterday. Mm-hmm. The announcers today have an entirely different work to do. I understand that different ball clubs today demand that the announcers be more homers and rooters and
that's right.
obvious.
That's right. They're employees of the club. And
MacPhail told me, you announce the game as you see it. And if my ball club needs to be burned, you burn it. And Ricky told me, you're closer to the microphone to your job than any other living human being. You do it the way you see do it. And George Weiss at Yankee Stadium mm-hmm. Never gave me an instruction. He wanted the game broadcast. In other words, these men said, we'll take care of the color of the ball club. Mm-hmm. You just put the ball game out. You all right, honey?
I promise I won't cut up again.
No, you're fine, please.
I don't know really what happened, though.
Your trip
came over to Brooklyn. A team in Ebbets Field that was called, I always remembered it as Power Hitters Paradise. And I heard there are two expressions that you came up with that are, what was it, FOB, full of Brooklyns.
Yeah.
And also something about a pea patch.
Yeah.
Those were two expressions that you came up with. What did the one about the pea patch mean? I don't recall the exact
one. Well, the expression of tearing up the pea patch means there's a lot of excitement.
Oh, a lot of excitement, okay.
That's right. And, yes, I came up with some expressions, but I never use them as frequently as people give me credit to use them because you wear out of expressions. I put rhubarb into the language.
You did?
Yeah. Huh. Oh, yes.
In what way?
Yes. The year before I came to Brooklyn, there were... there was an argument in a Brooklyn bar, and a Brooklyn fan got so incensed he went out and got a pistol and came back and shot another fan in the stomach at the bar and killed him. The man died. And Tom Meany, I think I mentioned him earlier, mm-hmm. another aspect. Tom Meany lived in that neighborhood, and he came in the bar the next day to get a drink. And the bartender said, Mr. Meany, you should have been here last night. We had a rhubarb. Meaning blood all over the place.
Yeah,
and Meany told that story to Gary Schumacher, who was a baseball writer for the Journal American. And when I came to Brooklyn in 39, Schumacher once in a while, when there'd be some imbroglio mm-hmm. on the field, a big argument with the umpire, so would laugh and say, oh, what a rhubarb or something. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up and began to give credit to Schumacher. And then Meany came up and said, well, look, you know, I gave it to Schumacher, so then I gave credit to Meany for a little bit. then I just stopped giving credit to anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And the word was picked up and went into the language.
Yeah, just became part
went
of
into the language. And it was very apt when DeRocher would challenge Big George Major Kurt or something like that. That was that. And then mm-hmm. sitting in the catbird seat. I popularized that. You see Catbird Seat now
yes,
written all the time,
yeah.
meaning a person is in a place of advantage, mm-hmm. sitting pretty, something.
Yeah.
In Cincinnati, in a little Penny Ante stud poker game, I tried to force a man out and didn't. I raised every bet, and as he turned over aces back to back, and as he raked in the pot, he said, thank you for all your raises, because from the start, those aces back to back, I was sitting in a Catbird Seat. That's the first time I'd heard it,
uh-huh.
and I figured, in as much as I'd paid for it, I certainly was entitled to use it,
yes, sir.
So I began to use it. People associate me with the expression, oh, doctor. As far as I'm concerned, the only time I ever used it was when John Friel caught the DiMaggio's bid for a home run
mm-hmm.
in Game 6 of the 1947 World Series. That just came out,
yeah.
oh, doctor, and when I saw that white ball against his black glove. Tearing up the pea patch, I guess that's just an expression I'd heard. The only expression that I coined was FOB. I deliberately coined that for the Brooklyn, but I didn't use that too much.
Oh, the reason why I say it, because when I was growing up in Kansas City, moved to Kansas City after the war, and I was a member of the Knothole Gang, and in those days that was Kansas City Blues, which was
the Yankees.
Yankee farm system.
Right.
And I remember the broadcaster, Larry Ray, he would always say, basically, he said, FOB, full of blues. And I'm sure he picked that up from you in earlier years because I grew up, when the bases were loaded, it was FOB, full of blues. And until I read about the FOB, full of Brooklyns. You broadcast the first night Major League Baseball
first night game.
First would you
night
tell
game
us?
Was
in Cincinnati.
In May of 1935.
Could you tell Cincinnati. Something about, there must have been, you know, excitement, you know, is this thing going to work? Are the lights going to explode? The game, of course, has changed tremendously.
Nobody knew what the first night game was going to be like.
I guess it was done to boost attendance.
What?
I guess it was done to boost attendance in Cincinnati.
Oh, yes. Larry MacPhail was quite an innovator. MacPhail was the first man to fly a ball club in the pennant race for the Reds in 34 to Chicago and back. He fought for night baseball and had to get the support of Commissioner Landis to do it because most of the National League clubs were reluctant to do it. And MacPhail said, well, all I want is seven. Night, at that time, you had eight teams in the league.
Mm-hmm.
I want seven night games. That's the same as seven extra Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
And so each team in the league would have one night game. And MacPhail came up with the first season ticket plan in 1934. He went to Brooklyn and put in lights there. He broke the broadcasting ban that had been in effect for 5 years between the Yankees, Giants, and Dodgers. Went on the air in 39, brought me to Brooklyn. Then MacPhail was at the Yankee Stadium, put in lights. MacPhail was the first man to have all of his broadcasts live. He put Mel Allen on the road in 1946. And the other teams had to follow suit before long, and that ended Western Union Recreations from the studio.
He was the old telegraph key kind of thing.
He was a very dynamic man. I like to say that MacPhail and Ricky brought baseball into the modern age. Ricky with the farm system and with the neighbor ball player. Between those two, I don't know what baseball would be today if they hadn't.
And MacPhail in terms of communication and transportation.
And as far as that first night game was concerned, most of the people in baseball had woeful negative predictions about it. They thought that
such
visibility would not be good.
Oh, okay.
And they thought that people would not be interested in going out at night. In other words, it wasn't tradition. Baseball event in the sunshine with the green grass, etc. It just is not, you know, there's a terrible, the tradition is an awful hand on somebody. So, of course, it's never been done. Well, it shouldn't be done.
Okay.
But MacPhail arranged to have this first night game. He arranged to have President Franklin D. Roosevelt press a Western Union key on his desk and throw the lights on for the first time. He had a big fireworks display, and the Phillies were the team that first night, and it was an excellent game. But people, I know on a radio interview on WLW, before the program, a lot of big shots were interviewed. And most of them predicted very, very negatively. Claude Griffith, who then owned and ran the Washington Senators, he was aghast. He said, no, it's just terrible. But then when Griffith saw how good the lights were and the attendance, he led the fight for unlimited night baseball. Money is a great solvent.
That's right. It's a good motivator in that
way. And everybody fell in line as soon as they saw that it's a funny thing how quickly people jump on a success.
Yes, sir. It has many mothers and fathers, but the failure has, is an orphan.
So patriotic, he was fighting for unlimited night ball during the war because you said the war workers are entitled to entertainment in the evening.
Well, you also broadcast the first Major League TV game, and that was in Brooklyn.
1939, television was very experimental. I don't think there were, somehow the estimate between 300 and 500 receiving sets in the New York City area. And that's where television began. NBC had the experimental station, and they broadcast from the tower of the Empire State Building.
Okay.
That was the antenna. Well, the man who was in charge of programming for that experimental TV station was Alfred H. Morton. They called him Doc, D-O-C, Doc Morton. And I had several meetings with Morton. We knew each other casually. And he called and asked would I come by his office as a favor to him. So I stopped by. And he said, well, Red, I want very much to do a big league baseball game on television. We have had one baseball game on television this spring. Princeton at Columbia and Bill Stern was the announcer.
Old Bill Stern.
Well, as Morton said, you know, the Yankees and the Giants hate radio, and they kept radio out of New York for 5 years, so they certainly wouldn't be interested in letting me come in with television. There's no reason for me to try to get permission from the Yankees to do a Yankee game or the Giants to do a Giants game. And I understand MacPhail is a very temperamental fellow. It depends on how you meet him. And I don't know him. But you know him. You worked for him in Cincinnati. Would you, now this is the man running NBC television, would you, as a favor to me, would you ask MacPhail, would he allow me to televise a game, any game he chooses? So I went to MacPhail, and I told you earlier, MacPhail's first in baseball, and the conversation was very, very short. I just walked in, and Larry was sitting at his desk. I said, Larry, do you want another first? He never has said. He said, sure, what is it? I said, televise a big league ball game. He said, sure. I said, well, here's the number. Call Doc Morton. He got Morton on the phone, and he said, well, I've got a doubleheader coming up on a Saturday with Cincinnati here. It's already sold out, so I can't lose anything. Mm-hmm. I'll let you televise the first game, but I want something for it. He said, I want you to install a receiving set in the press room so that I can see the television, and the board of directors of the club can see it, and the writers can see it. So Morton agreed, and the NBC put in one of those rare receiving sets, put it in the day of the game, and then took it out the next day. But so that's the first fee that television paid to sports, the first fee. The use of a receiving set.
Did they have three or four cameras around the field, or was it just one on top of the roof?
They had two cameras, and they, of course, were black and white. Nobody ever thought about the color. And one camera was on the ground floor, back of home plate, the cover shot, they called it. The other camera was on the second deck, back of third base, right out where the fans. And that's where I sat.
You sat right out there broadcasting the game?
Yes, I broadcasted. And there were no monitor. Nobody thought about a monitor. And the only way, the connection I had between my earphones and the director, Bert Crotty in the truck, went out. So I was just sitting there about it. And the only way I knew which camera was operating was to see which red light on the camera was coming on and which way it was pointed. So that's the way the person was done. There were three sponsors on the radio broadcast that year. Ivory Soap, Mobile Dash, and Wheaties. And NBC, I guess at MacPhail's urging, agreed to give each of those radio sponsors a free commercial. So as far as I know, those were the first commercials in the history of television. And I know that they turned the camera on me, and I just held up a bar of Ivory Soap and ad-libbed a few words about it. And then later on, they turned the camera on me, and I put on a mobile gas service station attendant's cap, held up a can of Mobile. I'll talk about that a little bit. And then the big commercial was Wheaties. When they turned the camera on me, I shook some Wheaties in a bowl, sliced a banana, sprinkled a little sugar, put on some milk, and said, that's a breakfast of champions. They haven't improved on that one yet.
No, they haven't. Oh, that's good.
Then we didn't hear much more about television because World War II. And they had no use for television. And it was too expensive in both men and materials. So television came on, as they say, like gangbusters as soon as World War II was over.
And today it's a driving force in terms of revenues and and monies. Exciting years, and I like for the record if this story about the Dodger, and I mispronounced it, Symphony, was that it? That I that our minister asked me to share, ask you about.
Four fellows, I think, who had regular jobs. They drove trucks, this, that, and the other. They didn't know a note of music among them. And one fellow would beat the cymbals, and one fellow beat a drum. One fellow had a horn, a trumpet. And I forget what the other fellow had. But anyhow, for years, they had been regular attendants for those afternoon games. They'd get off from work, and they'd come in there. Jack Collins, the business manager, already reserved four seats on the lower stands back of first base. And they would sit there, and they'd make a lot of noise. And you didn't hear much music, but they'd make a lot of noise. And what they'd like to do was beat the drum for an opposing player, say he'd struck out, and they'd march him back to the dugout. Then they'd, when he sat down on the bench, they'd crash the cymbals and sit him down. And the players got into it. Sometimes the player would wait inning after inning before he'd sit down on it. But they'd wait for him. And I named them the Dodger Symphony. with a heavy accent on the phony.
Phony.
Dodger Symphonic. And,
well, I understand that you sang or that you sang a part of this. Is there a recording of this?
Beg pardon?
Is there a recording of this?
Not to my knowledge, unless you're listening to one of the radio broadcasts.
Uh-huh.
But in those days, you didn't have tape.
Well, yes, they were just wire recorders.
They weren't taping programs in radio then.
That's right. You were with the Dodgers from 1938 until...
1939 through 53.
53 years. And the Boys of Summer, that comes to my mind.
Yeah.
In terms
Roger
of...
Kahn.
Roger Kahn's book. Of those years in Ebbets Field, it was one of those fields where the fans were part of the action. You're right down with
it. It was such a small ballpark.
Uh-huh. It was... what were two or three of the most memorable games that you broadcast for the Dodgers? It was one of them, perhaps, when Mickey Owens dropped that third strike against Tommy Hendrick.
A memorable game, but I didn't broadcast that play.
Oh, you didn't?
No. Bob Elson and I were doing that World Series, mm-hmm. the 1941 World mm-hmm. Series, and I had the first half of that game,
mm-hmm.
and he had the second half.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Elson who okay. did the play-by-play of that.
Okay.
I was called on to do a summation and do some coloring
okay.
and try and talk about it.
Okay. I'm going to turn the tape over now and then go back to the question about two or three memorable games that you broadcast with the Dodgers.
Is always annoying you?
No. I when he comes over, I just pet him and no problem whatsoever.
How do you feel?
Three games that are memorable when the years you were with the Dodgers, as a journalist or as a human interest?
Dan, with the philosophy I had, I don't have any particular games that are memorable particularly. As
mm-hmm.
far as I tried not to be a fan. I tried not to think in terms of the winning or the losing. I tried to think in terms of one... preparing myself to do the broadcast and reporting it to people who couldn't see it for themselves and let them react as they wanted to.
But you saw some exciting plays that really, you put that kind of excitement when you saw that good play and you called it.
I would say that the one are two plays that mm-hmm. I recall, and maybe it's because I wrote about them to some extent in my book, 1947, When All Hell Broke Loose in Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
The most exciting moment, and I guess maybe it was the most exciting moment in the history of Ebbets Field, was when Lavagetto pinch hit with two men out mm-hmm. In the ninth inning, two men on against Bill Bevins in Game 4 of the mm-hmm. 47 World Series, the Yankees leading 2-1. Bevins hadn't given up a hit, mm-hmm. and Lavagetto doubled off the right field wall, mm-hmm. broke up the no-hitter and scored the two runners and mm-hmm. broke up the ball game.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's ever been so much excitement in Brooklyn, not
okay.
certainly. And then in that same series, two games later, I remember John Fredo's catch of DiMaggio's bid for a home run, and I remember that DiMaggio, who was always imperturbable in the public, mm-hmm. as he came into second base thinking he had a home mm-hmm. run, suddenly realized he didn't and started kicking dirt. Mm-hmm. It's the only time.
That famous picture.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one about Bucky Harris when he told Bevins, you know, Bevins walked a number of men. It wasn't a perfect game. But I don't remember who he walked, but he violated one of the basic laws I always heard about managers, and that is don't walk the winning run to first base.
Well, I took that up in my book at some length. Mm-hmm. They say there's a book in baseball, but I've never seen that book. Everybody refers to the book. They say, but you have to play the game according to your situation and mm-hmm. according to the manpower. When Harris made that decision, there was a pinch hitter at the plate named Pete Reiser.
Yeah.
And there was a runner at first base. So the tying run was at first base, mm-hmm. and the winning run was at the plate. Mm-hmm. Reiser was unable to play in the outfield because his right ankle was sprained. They found mm-hmm. out later there was a broken bone mm-hmm. on it. But when you are batting, you hit off your rear foot. And there was nothing wrong with his rear foot, his left foot. Mm-hmm. And Ebbets Field has a very short right field mm-hmm. and a high fence. And Reiser was a dead pull hitter and a former batting champion, a very mm-hmm. dangerous man at the plate. Bevins had been wild. He had walked 9 men. He's now behind on Reiser, 3-1, and 2 men are out. And what Harris wanted was, remember, Reiser, a left-handed batter. Mm-hmm. Harris did not want Bevins grooving a 3-1 pitch mm-hmm. to Reiser that Reiser could very well hit against the wall mm-hmm. or into Bedford mm-hmm. Avenue. So he said, put him on. Mm-hmm. And also, Harris knew that Reiser was the last left-handed batter the shotgun of the Dodgers had. And he knew that whoever came up to bat next, Stanky was due to hit, would have to be a right-handed batter. Mm-hmm. So I would say that Harris instantly made the decision that he wanted Bevins to start fresh against a right-handed batter. Mm-hmm. And the heck with ball four, what the book said. So Reiser was put on at first base. And with a bad ankle, he was immediately substituted for. Mm-hmm. And Eddie Mixer mm-hmm. ran for him. And John Friedo, who had stolen second, was at second base. Mm-hmm. So that was another factor. Yeah. I admired Harris's courage. Also in that inning, with 2 men out, Shotton ordered John Friedo to steal second base. Mm-hmm. Well, suppose Barrow's throw had been a little earlier, mm-hmm. a little lower, and John Friedo had been tagged out and the game is over, and Bevins has his no-hitter. What would have been the criticism of Shotton for making mm-hmm. that move? A manager has to make the first decision, and he has many many reasons why mm-hmm. he makes the decision. Mm-hmm. And people should be very careful in trying to second guess a manager mm-hmm. or a football coach. Mm-hmm. I mean, they know so much more about the situation mm-hmm. and about the players involved. A manager knows who he wants, when he wants to do something.
If he has confidence in that player to do the job.
Yeah.
I remember seeing pictures of it as a kid. Of course, I grew up as a Yankee fan, you know, growing up in Kansas City, a farm team of the Yankees, and I followed them religiously.
I think, let me go back. Okay. I think probably any manager in the situation that Harris was in mm-hmm. would have ordered ball four.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a sound, mm-hmm. play. Mm-hmm. What broke it up was Lavagetto.
That's right. That's right. He came in and...
But this is the ball game.
Right.
This is why people are interested in baseball, why they go to ball games.
Predictable.
You never know, right down to the last pitch.
You mentioned Pete Reiser.
Yeah.
I've read about a lot of him, and I haven't asked you about too many baseball players and your recollections, but I've heard of him and Spud Chandler as two of the most ardent competitors in the game. That they went for broke every time they went out there on the field. And Pete Reiser, I guess he just bummed himself up so much and got injured over and over again because there was no fence that he would ever, if it meant bouncing into it to get that ball, he did it.
I am talking about something I have not seen for myself. I have not observed this. I have not been around ball players since 1966. The game has changed. The big money has come in. Mm-hmm. Agents have come in. Mm-hmm. Players get guaranteed contracts. Mm-hmm. Fabulous amounts of money. Just it seems to me... fantastic, impossible, illogical, and baseball is getting itself in debt with these salaries where I don't know how they're going to ever pay themselves out. But the players of my time didn't have the television money. They had to hope to get to the World Series to get extra money. They would have to fight to get a $500 raise or a $1,000 a year raise. DiMaggio has a great year, and Ed Barra cut him with the Yankees when he was a young ball player, just so he would keep his place. The general manager did everything, the owners did everything they could to keep the ball players down. So the ball players of my era, the Pete Reeses and the Spud Chandlers, were much more hard-bitten competitors than they are today. You can't convince me that a ball player with millions of dollars in a contract is going to go up against a concrete wall to catch a fly ball. Reeser went up against a concrete wall just to catch the ball.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Chandler was a hard-bitten pitcher until bone chips in his arm cut his career.
Mm-hmm.
But you had ball players in those days, when I came up, were all hard-bitten competitors.
Yeah.
They all were, and
just played hungry.
And you didn't have so many ball clubs. You only had 16 major league ball clubs, and the managers could afford to be very, very rough and very selective. Bill Terry of the Giants, for example, was a very rough man. I remember there was a thing about a ball player didn't want to sign his contract. Mm-hmm. He wanted a little more money, and Terry didn't hesitate. He said, "Boy, sign that contract, or I'll send you so far the sporting news can't find you." And the player signed him. Bill Rizzuto went in to talk to Ed Barra when he was a young ball player to try and get a few hundred dollars raised. And Barra said, "Listen, you sign this contract and get the hell out of here." And Rizzuto said, "I did. He's getting me to death." Well, you don't have that anymore.
That's right. Yeah. You got the agents, you got the union, you got the... I heard...
You can't... finding a ball player today doesn't mean anything.
Oh, no.
In my times, you find a ball player that took something off the table.
It did indeed. And when the World Series pop was, I think, in the late 40s, the winners could take home $5,000, which was the full year salary for some of the players.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right there in the World Series.
Mr. Rickey used to say, "I want hungry ball players who want to win to get in the World Series."
You brought up Branch Rickey and his contribution about the... setting up a farm system. Weren't there farm systems in the major leagues before he came on the scene?
No, Rickey started it.
So where did
when Rickey was running the St. Louis Cardinals, they were so broke that 1 year they couldn't go to spring training camp. At one time they didn't have a second set of uniforms. But John McGraw of the Giants, with all the money, if he wanted a shortstop, he looked around and bought him. And so did other clubs with money. They just bought the ball players they wanted. They didn't develop them. Now, Mr. Rickey could think, and he had patience. He could wait. And he said, "Well, I don't have any money, and I don't have any ball players worth trading. I'm going to have to develop my ball players.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to send scouts out around the country and bring in young ball players and sort them out and put on, on minor league ball clubs and have managers who are teachers more than managers and train these ball players. And in a few years," that's what Mr. Rickey said, "and in a few years I will have a crop of ball players, even a surplus."
So he set up the different classification
system. That's right, and he moved them up. And by 1926, his farm system had produced the Cardinals that beat the Yankees. 1926. That was the famous strikeout of Alexander Baldessari.
And
the mighty Yankees of Babe Ruth.
Murderer's Row and the whole thing.
Mr. Rickey, out of his own mind. And then baseball changed. And the Yankees immediately started a farm system. That's when Ed Barra brought in George Weiss to run the farm system.
Right.
And the Yankees came up with a splendid one.
Right.
MacPhail was a great devotee of the farm system. Because with the farm system, you control the ball players. And if you didn't have your own farm system, you had to go and deal with these people who had them in the farm system.
Because the owners...
The players, the minor leagues, were now not available for you just to go in and buy a ball player.
So was the scouts going after scouting the countryside?
Huawei, what's he doing?
I don't know. He's just
having a wonderful time running back and forth. You were there when Jackie Robinson came on board, and you expressed some feelings that although you said, "I'm a broadcaster, I report only what's out there." There have been many stories written about Jackie Robinson coming up with the Dodgers and some even resentment that was on the Dodger bench that supposedly was there and whether he would fit in, and especially when the team would go out on the road, where he would stay and all that. you knew Jackie Robinson. What are some recollections you have that maybe in the have been published, but as you recall about Ranch Rickey and doing something that was totally revolutionary, untraditional?
People have forgotten or chosen to forget the role of Ranch Rickey, because Mr. Rickey, as a matter of principle, went against all of baseball. Mm-hmm. And went against everyone in his family when he broke the color line. That took a very strong man to do that.
Yes, it did.
And he was very intelligent in his doing it. He put a Negro team called the Brooklyn Brown Dodgers in the Negro League.
Mm-hmm.
And had his scouts scouting Negro players. And the scouts didn't know it, but they were also scouting for a suitable Negro player to come to the White Dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
And Robinson's name kept recurring over and over in scouting reports. Mr. Rickey never saw Robinson play in the Negro League. He trusted his scouts' appraisals.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sent for Robinson to come into his office, and he told Robinson that he was under consideration to break the color line. And he wanted to find out if Robinson spiritually could do it. And he canvassed the whole situation in about a three-hour meeting. He told Robinson all he'd have to undergo, all he'd hear, mm-hmm. what his wife would hear, etc., etc. And at the end, he said to Robinson, can you do it? And Robinson said, I've got to do it. And then Mr. Rickey said, the only way you can do it is that for 3 years, you won't answer back. You will have to take what is given to you. And everyone knows that Robinson was a splendid physical player, especially on base. Mm-hmm. We don't have to go into that. But the thing that people don't understand is how that man, for 3 years, as competitive as he was, mm-hmm. Rickey said he was the most competitive ball player since Ty Cobb, how he silenced himself, how he took the abuse,
mm-hmm.
and he took all that went with it. For 3 years, he kept his end of the bargain. And I like to think, referring to my book, 1947, which is available in paperback, I like to think that that is very thoroughly covered in that mm-hmm. book. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't remember, one, the courage of Mr. Rickey to make the decision, and two, to execute by selecting the man who would do it.
Not
if Robinson had failed, in other words, Mr. Rickey might have ruined the Brooklyn franchise
mm-hmm.
When he went into it. Nobody knew what.
Mm-hmm.
His board of directors was not pleased. Walter O'Malley was never pleased about that.
Mm-hmm.
O'Malley, you know, after he took over the ball club, tried to trade Robinson to the Giants.
Oh,
Robinson quit.
Retired right there. And I heard that one of the most intelligent, ablest players of his day was Billy Herman. Played for the Dodgers, didn't he? Did you see him play?
Billy Herman?
Mm-hmm, Billy Herman.
Oh, sure. I saw. Billy Herman was playing second base for the Chicago Cubs, first game I ever broadcast, 1934. And I was at Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I broadcast him when he would come in with the Cubs. Uh-huh. I was at Brooklyn when McPhail got him in 1941. And he cemented that pennant-winning ball club. Mm-hmm. Sure, I knew Billy quite well.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a very intelligent player. He moved very intelligently around second base mm-hmm. on playing different hitters.
Yeah.
Was an excellent batter, hit-and-run man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He was a splendid ball player.
You went over to the Yankees in 54.
Yeah.
And here, if there could be other two teams that had such intense rivalry, especially in the 40s and 50s, it was the Yankees and the Dodgers.
No, the Yankees and the Giants. I mean, the Dodgers and the Giants, that was the intense
rivalry.
Oh,
that was even more intense than...
Oh,
well,
my
I guess
goodness,
I,
yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I guess being American League...
The Dodgers and the Giants were in the same league.
Well, that's
as
true.
As well as in
yeah.
the same town.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time that ever happened in, mm-hmm. in the big leagues.
Red, honey.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. That would be because the New York was the only team in those days that had three teams,
mm-hmm.
and two of them in the National and one in the American.
Put him in the kitchen with it.
Oh, he's fine.
Well, I'm afraid he's so excited. Please do that, honey. Just put him in there.
Oh, he's fine. He's fine.
I'll give him a bite. Come on, boy.
We're going over to Yankees and broadcasting. Is that when Lee McPhail went over from Brooklyn then to the Yankees organization that you... went with him to begin broadcasting with the Yankees?
Well, this is a very long, involved story. But I was personally very fond of Mr. Rickey.
Mm-hmm.
And after the season of 1950, O'Malley took over the ball club. Rickey went to Pittsburgh. And the chemistry between O'Malley and me never could be good. He tried and I tried. But I was always Ricky's friend. And I told O'Malley that I would be perfectly happy to tap the contract and let him have the broadcast of his choice. He said, oh, no, we want you to stay here. But I said, however, I want you to know that Mr. Ricky was always going to be my friend. He said, well, I respect you for it. But he couldn't. He was asking too much.
Yes.
Asking too much. And as it came to the end of the season of 53, I had made a decision. Craig Smith of the Gillette Safety Razor Company would just have his agency man call you and say, you're on the World Series. And you'd never know what you were going to even get paid. And I got sick and tired of that. And after the World Series of 1952, which was seven games and coast-to-coast television, I got a check of $1,400, $200 a game. Well, the first World Series I was on, 39, radio, got a check of $70 a game, $280 for a game. Sure. Smith just, he was a dictator. He's speaking of a dictator. He sent you what he wanted to send you. And I had always negotiated with everyone else. And so I told Lila, my wife, and my agent, Bill McCaffrey, that after the series of 52, I said, if I'm nominated to be on the series the next year, which it looked as though I would be because Brooklyn was so powerful a team, and I was, I said, he's going to have to negotiate with me. I'm not saying how much I want to get paid, but I want to know in advance what I'm going to get paid. I've negotiated with everybody else. So the end of the season came. Brooklyn had won the pennant. And then, in those days, the principal announcer for the team that won the pennant was automatically on the World Series. Well, the agency man called me at St. Louis and said, Reg, you're on the World Series with Mel Allen. I said, yeah. He said, well, we announced it, released it to the press yesterday in New York, but I forgot to call you. Well, if I needed any further inspiration. So I said, well, you know, my agent, Bill McCaffrey, called him and make the details. Well, my goodness. McCaffrey called him a few minutes and said, boy, you sure you want to go through with this? Because Wilhelm is very angry. And I said, yeah. And then he called back and I said, Wilhelm says that Craig Smith in Boston is raging at your effrontery and said, you get what you got last year, take it or leave it. And I said, I leave. And that was my last World Series, 52. I never was on another one again. But I kept my self-respect. That day happened to be my daughter's birthday, 16th birthday. And I told her when I got home from St. Louis that night, I said, well, sir, I've given you the best birthday present I can. I've given you your father's self-respect. And I'm prouder of that World Series that I rejected of the 13 that I broadcast. And for the next 10 years, I worked for Armed Forces Radio on their World Series broadcast to the troops overseas for nothing. There's no negotiation about that. And then, as I say, this is a long story. When I got back to New York, the next morning, I called O'Malley to tell him what was going on about his Crystal radio announcer, broadcaster. And I no sooner got him on the phone and started, he said, well, that's your problem. I'll put Scully on the World Series. So I just hung up the phone. As I hung it up, I said to myself, well, Walter, you and the Dodgers, that's your problem. So I was through. My contract was expired in another week anyhow. But I said, I'm through. So when I went to the Yankees, I was out of work. The World Series was going on, and George Weiss wanted to talk to me about doing the pre- and post-game and some play-by-play at Yankee Stadium. And I think the fact that I had been a reporter, a broadcaster, not rooting for a team, made it possible for me to go from Brooklyn right across the river to Yankee Stadium, and I never got a criticism about it. People accepted the fact that I was broadcasting.
You were broadcasting the game, and
yeah.
You saw some fantastic baseball history, of course, that Yankee dynasty of the late 50s. Early 50s, and of course, late 50s.
But when George Weiss was running the Yankees, he ran them for 12 years. And he and Casey Stengel to him had 10 pennants, so something like that.
That's right, yeah. Indeed. In terms of journalism, I remember the reading a great deal of baseball history by Red Smith of the New York Times, if I remember correctly.
He was the best sports columnist.
Could you tell me
columnist.
What your...
He was the best sports columnist I ever knew anything about, and I sent you on the air frequently. And I think all of his peers admitted it. He was a superb columnist. He was extremely honest. He was very indefatigable. I asked him one time the secret of being a successful columnist, and he said, be there. And he saw to it that he was there for the events. He was not writing about something he had imagined or heard about. He was there to see it for himself. And he had a beautiful respect. He had a beautiful flow of English.
Yes,
he had a great respect for the language. He was a journalist in the fullest sense of the word. And a very fine man. Very fine man of character.
Mm-hmm.
Impeccable character.
We have spent about an hour and a half together. I could spend all
of me.
Oh, okay. I didn't want to overextend. You broadcast a number of games. You broadcast the perfect game by Don Larson in the 56th U.S. Armed Services.
I just told you, my last World Series broadcast was 52.
Oh, I thought you broadcast for the U.S. Armed Services Network.
Well, what we did for Armed Forces Radio, they could not take commercials on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So we sat in the studio working on radio for Armed Forces Radio with the television picture in front of us.
We listened
to the radio, because we had to synchronize with that.
I see.
And as soon as the out would be made at the half inning, we cut off the radio sound, and then we commented upon it until it was ready to start, and we could tell when we were going to start on the television.
Oh, okay.
Then we would do a commentary before and after the game.
Mm-hmm.
When the games were live in New York, I would do pregame interviews. I remember in the Yankee dugout, I interviewed Stengel and some other people, some of the writers were having sort of a bad time trying to get interviews and stuff. And I didn't have any problem. I remember Arthur Daly made a very snide contract. Mm-hmm. He said, privileged microphone. I said, yeah, Armed Forces.
Yeah, that's right. I have always heard that Casey Stengel loved to talk baseball, night and day.
Sure.
Anybody that would listen to him, including the coaches, and you recall any particular, I heard that he brought up the platoon system in baseball, in Major League Baseball.
They called it the platoon system. But to my recollection, the first manager who used every player that he could use for an inning was DeRosa during World War II, and I called it managing in depth. Because you had so few good ball players, and Leo had an amazing ability to get an inning out of this fella, and an at-bat out of this fella, and a start out of this fella, and a relief out of that fella. To my personal knowledge, DeRosa was the first man to do that.
Started it.
But managing in depth was a phrase that didn't catch on. But when Stengel came and began moving players back and forth, they called it platooning, and that caught on.
Okay. That's what I remembered as a kid, I didn't hear the
But DeRosa... DeRosa was doing it during World War II.
With the Yankees, I'll ask the same question that when you were with the Dodgers broadcasting. I'm prejudicial because of my growing up as a Yankee fan, and I have such a love affair with those teams. Are there any particular players that come to your mind that really represent the heart of baseball in those days, the love of the game? With the Yankees in the late 50s, early 60s?
Ben, I'll go back over this again. People seem to have an idea that I was a fan.
I
liked this ball player or disliked this ball player, etc. I saw to it that I had as little emotional attachment as I could. Mine was a different job.
Well, I
mine was to tell people, other people, about the play of the ball game. I was never in a ball player's house, and I never had a ball player in my house. And I stayed to myself.
Hmm.
When the team was on the road,
I
traveled on a plane. There were four of us that played bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Wally Moses, a coach, and Joe Ripley for the advertising people, and Joe Cooper, the engineer.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed away from the ball players.
I wasn't saying that.
I had a job to do, and they respected me for it. So that's the best I can.
Okay.
You remember Mantle hitting home runs. I was a broadcaster when Maris hit his 61st on television. Mm-hmm. You remember things like
sure,
that.
Right.
And you remember Whitey Ford pitching some great games. Mm-hmm. Just, you remember Preacher Roll pitching some great games and Carl Erskine and like that, Paul Derringer and Bucky Walters.
Sure.
But these were workmen as I saw it.
I
was a workman. Mm-hmm. And this is the relationship I tried to have.
Okay.
And the ball players, I think, appreciated that. I never saw a ball player stop talking when I went in the dugout, which was quite a compliment.
Yes, it would be.
A lot of writers would come in the dugout, they'd stop talking. Now, I think
that would be the test of respect right there.
I think this gives you pretty much
interview. Okay. Another name comes to my mind about who's added a great deal with baseball is Paul Richards.
Never around Paul Richards much. He was always a visiting manager when I was around.
I see. I always heard he...
He came in with the Orioles.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
he came in with the White Sox.
Mm-hmm.
When I first met Richards, he was about a third-string catcher who didn't do much catching for the New York Giants.
That's right. I heard he... Earl Weaver, when I interviewed him, acknowledged that he learned a great deal about
managing. Richards was a highly intelligent man.
And a theoretician of the game in terms of strategy and
no
the like.
Question,
I've asked a lot of questions. You've done brought back a lot of memories, your perspective as a broadcaster. Are there any things that you would like to kind of a summary that perhaps we glossed over or touch upon?
I sit here with you and my wife. My life has been guided and very blessed, and it's been taken out of my control at times, all for the good, and there's nothing about it I would change.
Okay. Mrs. Barber, you've been kind of the silent one here. I'm sure that as I've seen one of your daughter's book here and... you showed me your book. Your book earlier. Are there some recollections that in this illustrious family about baseball and journalism that come to your mind? Maybe from the book, your book, or from.
I'm trying to think. Well, the first thing that happened. Fred and I met, and then courted and married.
Mm-hmm.
I was just flabbergasted. The nuns had never told me a blooming thing about a baseball club.
So you were introduced in a hurry. Then all of a sudden, going off to Cincinnati with your husband to start up a new life out of Florida. But you come full circle and have returned home.
Yes.
I'm
glad.
Okay.
I think I'm kind of pushing him. I'm not sure that I'm going to get it. I would like to go to Jacksonville where I grew up, Fred.
Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
And live there.
Okay.
At the end.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. and Mrs. Barber, for this interview, and I'll have a copy made for you and send it to you. And on behalf of Baseball Hall of Fame and myself, thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate that.